Film Spotting is presented by PeerFlix. Trade DVDs online at peerflix.com/filmspotting. And by Dexter, a killer new series presented by Showtime. By day, Dexter Morgan is a likable forensic investigator for Miami Homicide, but by night, he dispenses a special kind of justice. Dexter premieres Sunday, October 1st at 10, 9 Central, with replays all week or watch it on demand anytime, only on Showtime. To subscribe, call 1-800-SHOWTIME or go to sho.com.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Sam Van Halgren. Coming up on this bonus edition of Film Spotting, Democracy and Idiocracy. We'll have a review of Mike Judge's new film, conspicuously absent from most theaters, plus listener feedback and music from Johnny Society. But first, the third film in our documentaries marathon, Hearts and Minds.
Sam, Hearts and Minds, the 1974 documentary, won the Best Documentary Feature Prize at the Academy Awards that year. And putting it in a context of the previous two films we've seen in our marathon, Bob Dylan, Don't Look Back from D.A. Pennebaker, and then the second film, Barbara Kopple's Harlan County, USA, the thing that strikes you right away, or at least struck me right away, is how big this topic is compared to the previous two films. Don't Look Back follows Bob Dylan. It's very tight. It follows Dylan on this British tour over, I believe, just a couple of months period of time. And it very much focuses on a certain time in Dylan's artistic and personal life. You go to Harlan County. Yes, it covers 13 months. And yes, Kopple has to go other places outside of Harlan County, Kentucky. And she takes on the kind of very nature of the struggle of mine workers everywhere. Right. But nevertheless, she got to just focus on these people and live with these people and tell this particular fight of these mine workers. Then you get to Hearts and Minds.
Yeah.
And Peter Davis here, he's trying to tell the entire story on some level in less than 2 hours of the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
And again, I don't want to downplay
why, what, how, the
I don't want to downplay the 13-month struggle of the mine workers in Harlan County, but really, you know, Vietnam, with all its implications and consequences, makes Harlan County look like a picnic.
Yeah.
So my question is, does Peter Davis pull it off?
You know, this movie immediately struck me visually, just the way, you know, Davis approached the material, immediately compelling in a way that the others weren't. Just the way he intercuts this this old movie footage, this big Irving Berlin extravaganza, the march to war, celebrating in some way the vision of the militaristic United States. And the way he shoots Vietnam is like, you know, it was almost created a sense of deja vu. Like, have I seen this Vietnam movie before? Is this, you know, is this from Oliver Stone's Platoon? Or it's really an amazing, you know, cinematic vision in some way. And there's almost a sense that we're not sure exactly what his take on it is. So it's easy to imagine approaching this film that it's very anti-war, knowing just the the drama of the Vietnam War and its legacy. But it's really interesting how it initially approaches this material. But as the movie goes on, I think, and the way I'm thinking of this whole documentary marathon, it's like it's a march to Michael Moore. When do we get to the Michael Moore version of documentary filmmaking in some way? And I feel like this is a huge step in the direction of Michael Moore in a way that certainly Harlan County never was. And I speak specifically to the fact that this film felt emotionally manipulative, particularly later in the film, in a way that Harlan County never, ever does. Harlan County allows its subjects to tell the story completely.
Mm-hmm.
Peter Davis has an agenda, and he is going to use his subjects however best befits, you know, his agenda. And his agenda is to lay down a condemnation of America's involvement, the U.S. involvement in Vietnam for the past 20 years. I mean, you know, initial involvement with Truman all the way up through Nixon in the early 70s. And that really turned me off, I have to say. And I can't speak about this movie from a historical context. I can imagine the effect this film had. Some of the images are just legendary. I mean, they're just historical images of the that capture the horror of this war and the dilemma of this war. The way he goes about making this film, by the end, I found I found manipulative.
Yeah.
And it really turned me off.
Okay. I'm actually with you, Sam. This is my disappointment so far of the marathon because of that very same reason. You mentioned Michael Moore, and you know, the fact is with Michael Moore's films is he is out front and center. You know that they're subjective from the get-go. And other than hearing Peter Davis maybe in one scene, he is trying to kind of hide behind the camera. He's trying to tell, it seems, an objective account of how things went. But it's very obvious that that's not what he's doing. So the fact that, there is that kind of duplicity about it bothers me a little bit. I'm fine with people trying to manipulate me as long as it's obvious that's what they're doing. You know. And here he's trying to shroud it a little bit. And I just felt like, for me, that I just got very annoyed with watching the film because I felt like... Yeah. He had, and I was leading to this in my setup, that he's trying to tell such a big story that he just needed to tighten it down and focus on one or two of these characters. Right. He could have had so much more power behind it, so much more of an impact, and so much more of an interesting story that probably could have answered the same questions. You mentioned this to me, that he mentions in the commentary that his three goals were to answer, why did we go to war? What did we do there? Mm-hmm. And then what, yeah.
What did
the
going do to us?
Yeah. And then what did it do to us? And those are great questions to ask, but it's such a huge endeavor that by the end, I feel like he's thrown a lot of really interesting footage together, but that's all it is it's really interesting footage. And I wished that there were moments where there were certain characters where Daniel Ellsberg, for example, really compelling, always interesting to
Pentagon
listen to.
Papers,
the other guy, Randy, I'm sorry I didn't take the note and write down his name, but there's a fighter pilot he talks to who is from like Oklahoma or something, and he is amazingly articulate and interesting and insightful and emotional. And why couldn't he have just... focused on some of those characters? Why couldn't he have given me their story?
Their perspective.
Their perspective. Yep. A little bit clearer, and it would have been interesting. Instead, he spends too much time trying to throw in things that are there deliberately, I think, just to provoke and unsettle us. There's a scene where, and I'm sure Peter Davis, I'm sorry, I don't know, is he still alive?
Yeah, he is.
Is he listening to the show right now?
Maybe.
I feel bad because, I mean, again, this is, it's an interesting document of a certain time, and I respect everything he did, but that doesn't change the fact that, as I said, I was annoyed watching it. And the reason I was is tackling such a big topic that there are all these things thrown in there that I didn't understand why they were there for. And I also didn't really understand, or I was surprised to find, that I felt like he was exploitive in some way.
Yep,
there's a whole
absolutely.
Sequence where we see him shooting characters, people, not characters, real people who are amputees, people who have been through the war. And while that could have been interesting or heartbreaking or whatever, bottom line is, I felt like there's one scene where a guy finally looks over at the camera and stares right at the camera, and it's like, I felt like that guy must have felt that, like, someone is just kind of using me in a way. Because it's not like Harlan County, where Barbara Coppola you never feel like she's judging or using these people. And,
here,
you feel like he just wanted some good footage.
Yeah. How can I use this?
How can I use this footage of someone who's had his leg blown off to show the horror of war? That's what I felt like, and it didn't work for
me. It's so interesting. I mean, you have one scene where, you know, a Vietnamese man is speaking in Vietnamese, and you hear the translation, they bomb the hell out of us, and then they come and take some
pictures,
which he's using as an ironic sort of comment on the militarism of the United States, when in fact totally reflects really on, I think, the feeling of this film.
Well, I think he was trying in a way to be self-deprecating.
In a way, but I think more so maybe than he even intended. But what really turned me off too, not only the sense of manipulation lingering on somebody's missing legs as they're telling you a story, going away from somebody's face, really kind of offensive.
I'll get into
in
one
way.
Of those scenes in a minute,
But for me, there's also a real contempt and a mocking tone of the American way of life, which you have somebody say, that, you know, he went into the military, signed up for the military, volunteered because he thought it was his duty as an American.
Uh-huh.
And now what he mourns, having, you know, lost his legs, is his love for America.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if this film went at it the same way that man's perspective was, you know, it just didn't take a cue from that man. There's no love of what America could be or hopes to be or represents in the world. There's only contempt. There's only mocking. There's only anger.
Yeah.
And I think that's Harlan County, USA is a film born of anger, moral outrage in some way, but it's never mocking.
Yeah.
It never mocks its opponents in any way.
No, I agree with you, and that's why there are scenes, you talk about that American way of life, there are scenes that, this is my whole point, that don't make any sense in the larger context, that I felt like were just thrown in and and kept me away from the more interesting personal stories. Right. Shots of, we see people talking about war, and we cut back to a coach in a football locker room. We don't even know where they are. Do we ever find out where they are? They're in a small town somewhere.
And it's just empty mockery.
And it's just empty of a coach being really ridiculous and violent, trying to get his players up for a game. And it's obviously ironic that you go from actual war to people playing war and the consequences of it.
It's
that's the other point he's trying to make is that people, real life and death, and then cut to cheerleaders crying about a play that didn't go right. You know, this is what he's doing. And it just feels empty and again takes me away from the really important stuff. And I'll tell you something else. There was a scene in particular, and I think the scene you described is this character who is in a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. We don't know he's in a wheelchair until the last scene of the movie. We keep seeing him, but it's always just in a medium close-up. You just think he's sitting somewhere, or he could be sitting somewhere. The last shot, the last time we see him, he finally decides to pull back as he's talking and show that he's in a wheelchair, and it felt, and then while he's talking, he starts focusing on his legs.
Yeah.
And talk about feeling exploitive or feeling he's just using this guy in a wheelchair.
Like, we don't care what you said for the past 5 minutes.
He's just lingering on that, and it's just, it wasn't necessary. You've got a guy in a wheelchair who, nothing that he's saying that comes before it, there's no big reveal. There's no all of a sudden some big shock that's revealed by the fact that he's in a wheelchair. I could have known that from the very beginning. He does that a lot. There's a character, an African-American character, who's really great to listen to and has interesting things to say. You only find out at the end that he's within a group of Vietnam
vets. That works. You're right.
And, but it would have been more interesting to see where he was. Who is he talking to? What kind of group does he belong to? Instead, it tries to frame him in this context of he's just this severed head talking. And then he pulls back later and shows us more information. I didn't understand why we just didn't get it from the beginning. So on the whole, I really was bothered by the film, because not even so much as offended as just I felt like I was getting a lot of interesting snippets of scenes that could have been interesting, but ultimately didn't add up to anything. It didn't give me anything when I walked away from it any more, you know, really knowledgeable about the Vietnam War. The only thing that really is amazingly powerful, and the one time where his mocking tone in the irony works beautifully, is the scene of this young boy absolutely devastated by his father. Apparently, I'm guessing his father, Vietnamese kid. It's at a South Vietnamese funeral home or whatever, and they're digging the grave, and they've got his picture, and the kid is just wailing. I mean, you know, nonstop for however many minutes you see. The kid's in tears, just excruciating pain about the loss of his father. They cut then to General William Westmoreland, who was in charge of the war. And he's trying to explain that the Vietnamese, they fight the way they do because to them, life's not sacred. They don't see, it doesn't mean as much to them as it does to us. And that's the one part where your jaw just absolutely drops because you can't help but see that sums up the whole idea that the film's getting at of how just clueless we were when it comes to understanding our enemy. And you've got the general who was in charge of fighting this war saying, well, they don't care about the loss of life. It doesn't mean anything to them. And you see that kid, and that's devastating.
Well, and I think that's the thing. I was looking through my notes. The correct word about viewing this film was annoyance. I was annoyed by it. But I looked through my notes, and there are just fascinating conversations that he captures on this film. Wonderful subjects. The fact that he gets Westmoreland in an interview. Fascinating, fascinating subject. So I almost want to recommend that you see this just for some of the bits.
Yeah.
It doesn't add up to much, unfortunately. I think there's material there that could add up to something. Unfortunately, his outrage, his anger, his mockery gets in the way.
Yeah, no, and I would just close by saying that, again, where I respect what he did is if you set out to tell a story on this level, you would do the same thing probably where you would go, I mean, you work in radio now. You've worked in radio, Sam, where you've had an assignment to go out and do something, and this comes back to that focus idea, and you think, okay, if I'm going to tell a story about the Vietnam War, I'm going to want to talk to the general.
Yeah.
I'm going to want to talk to Westmoreland. Yeah. I'm going to want to talk to a soldier. I'm going to need to talk to a lot of politicians and anybody who helped strategize the war. I'm going to need to talk to all these people.
And they go to the other side.
But what you really should have done is probably just taken a step back and said, who are the one or two most important people I need to talk to? Yeah. And let me try to get their story. That will tell the larger story. He's done a lot of great legwork and research in getting all these people on screen, but it doesn't add up to anything.
Well, you bring up the point. You just virtually defined Errol Morris as the Fog of War.
In fact, that's exactly
what that is.
And it's a better film for that reason.
Yeah. All right. Well, next week we will kick off a mini Errol Morris marathon with 1978's Gates of Heaven. After the break, a review of Mike Judge's Idiocracy, which was, I think, just pulled from another theater during that last second. I heard you say it's okay.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Sam. Time to announce this week's PureFlix DVD giveaway winner. The winner of The Proposition, which came out on DVD last week, one of our favorite films of the year so far. Congratulations to Brian Klinsport from Santa Monica, California. Look for your copy of The Proposition soon, courtesy of PureFlix.
Sign up for a free PureFlix account now by going to pureflix.com/filmspotting or to filmspotting.net, and you'll be entered to win Park Chan-wook's Lady Vengeance. Also out this week, Will Ferrell as the voice of the Man in the Yellow Hat, Curious George. Actually, I mean, just a ton of exciting releases.
Yes, there are. Let's get to them. Are you geared up for this, Sam?
Edward Norton in
Down in the Valley.
Best performance, male performance of the year so far in Down in the Valley.
One of your favorite
films
of the year.
One of my favorite films of the year so far.
Brutal.
That's right.
Brutal.
Fast and the Furious, Tokyo Drift, one we could probably agree on.
Yeah.
And then director Mary Harron's The Notorious Betty Page. I've got it at home right now. I'm excited to see
it.
I wish, you know, we missed it when it came out in the theaters earlier in the year. There's the French comedy Russian Dolls with The Beat That My Heart Skipped, Romain Duris, and Taiwanese director.
Say it, Sam. Say it. I dare you.
Shou Xian Ho's.
Please tell me that someone from Taiwan or someone who's familiar with this director, who is a legend.
I know.
One of the greatest filmmakers
his
in the world.
His name is not legendary in this America.
But anyway, his new film,
Three Times,
which we definitely want to see and will see. But someone please correct us on the name of that there.
And finally,
The Lake House.
Play along with the Battle of the Lake House yourself.
You have no idea how excited I am that this movie's out now. And finally, all of our listeners who missed it in the theaters will now be able to go and watch it and see that I'm right. They'll be able to get their girlfriend, their boyfriend, their significant other, and have a great night out watching the best date movie of the year.
We're going to have a whole episode of Film Spotting that's just going to be saying, reading listener emails and saying, I told you so, over and over
it's
and over
not
for
happen.
50, 60
no.
minutes.
No, they're going to write in telling me how right I was.
And how romantic you are.
Yes.
And how I have a cold,
you do.
Ice cold,
black,
cold heart.
Coal heart. Yeah, right. Okay. Also want to mention about PureFlix. We announced it last week on the show, our commercial contest. We know a lot of you out there are using PureFlix.
Right.
You get a shot at $100 worth of free DVDs. Send us your PureFlix success story. Give us a testimonial of how you've used PureFlix, traded one DVD you couldn't stand. You traded Stepmom and ended up getting
wow.
The Godfather.
Contempt
or
for
something.
Stepmom.
Yes.
Now, do you think people are embarrassed to admit that they actually owned a
no.
film that they got rid of? You should
because,
be proud.
Well, because I mentioned Stepmom because I don't know if you remember this, but back when DVD players first came out, I know I shouldn't say that. Back when
they
I got my first
packs.
One.
Is that what you're saying?
Back in 99, I got my first DVD player, and everyone who bought one at Best Buy got the five
Wait,
pack.
Wait, 91 did you say?
No, I said 99.
Oh, God.
Everybody who bought a DVD player at Best Buy got the same five movies. You got them free. You got a package of Lost in Space, Stepmom, and three other movies I've managed to forget. So that's why if you go to eBay at that time, you'd always see these movies at eBay, or go to any exchange store, they were always there. So
we don't need to know how you got your hands on this film that you got rid of. The fact is you got rid of it and you got something better
for it.
Tell us.
Send us that email, feedback@filmspotting.net, or send us a short MP3 clip, 30 seconds. Give us your commercial. We'll play it on the show,
right.
And you'll get $100 worth of free DVDs. We also we need to thank some people here, of course. Donations this week. We will put your nicknames on the site, filmspotting.net. Click on the notes in the notes for this show. There will be the link. And actually, Sam, I don't know, have you done any of the nicknames yet?
I'm afraid not.
Okay, because we do have to thank one person, Anne.
Anne Carrigan.
Anne is a Silver Club member. devoted listener. So,
I don't want to come up with it on the spot.
No, okay. You got to come up with a good one for him.
Give me a second. Keep talking.
Okay, I'll keep talking. Don't worry, I'll keep
Anne
talking.
Kerrigan.
We also wanted to mention that, of course, as we mentioned last week, this Saturday night, you'll get our second show. This is kind of an odd thing. We're giving you the bonus show on Wednesday. Then Saturday night, our full show, reviews of All the King's Men. Jackass number 2 we've thrown into the mix, and
number
Braff,
2 means poop. That's right.
Thank you, Sam.
Yeah.
It does. Thank you for pointing that out.
You're
I just thought it was the second movie. And
No.
Okay. Yeah. And Zach Braff in The Last Kiss. We're going to review
entendre.
Yeah, all three of those movies on our Saturday night Chicago Public Radio edition of the show. So look for that late Saturday night. Let's get to some quick poll questions here, Sam. Last week on the show, we asked, tying in with our top 5, which of these fall releases are you most excited to see? The choices were Babel, Borat, The Departed, The Prestige, and The Science of Sleep. How did it come out?
Coming out on top, 28%, The Departed, right behind that, 24%, Borat, 21%, The Prestige, 17%, The Science of Sleep, and 10% Babel. I think maybe in order of marketing budget, it's possible.
Maybe so.
I know I've seen The Departed trailer endlessly.
Yeah, but The Prestige has to be ahead of Borat. For sure.
God, you're right.
Yeah.
That's true.
But and Babel, curiously, I think number 2 on both of our lists, last on our listeners' poll here. So
all right.
Interesting. We also then have a new poll question tying in with the top 5 we're going to get to in our Saturday show. And we've explained it a little bit on our site already, but we'll have a full explanation in the Saturday show. So tune in for that. But we're doing top 5 instead of political pictures. We're going to do our top 5 80s movies. So tying in with that, this week's poll question: which of these 80s Best Picture winners is most overrated?
In alphabetical order: Amadeus, Chariots of Fire, Gandhi. You don't call Gandhi overrated, the
okay.
man.
No.
Out of Africa and Rain Man. I just don't want people to confuse that. You're not calling Gandhi the man overrated.
No,
the
never,
film.
Never.
Richard Attenborough's film.
Yes, exactly. Right. Some other quick notes here before we get into our review of Idiocracy. Sam, a while back in the dope sheet.
Yeah.
You mentioned a story about how you ended up watching Dogma recently, the Kevin Smith film.
That's right.
And you hated it the first time you saw like 15 minutes of it or something.
Right.
And then now you watched it and you liked it. I still don't like it. But the point is, you made a comment in there that one of our listeners caught, and I'm sorry I don't have his name in front of me, but you made a comment that you hadn't really seen any other Kevin Smith. And this listener wrote in and said, "Does this mean you've never seen Chasing Amy? For shame, I can't believe you would admit to such an atrocity in public, no less a newsletter sent to thousands. No excuses, Mr. Van Halgren. I expect a review in the next dope sheet." So do you want to come clean? You've
seen
it. I
will. I've seen it, and I like it. I don't know how I overlooked it.
You
in the
lied.
Heat of the moment.
You lied in the dope
to
sheet.
Make my
to make your
stronger.
Argument stronger. You are Peter Davis.
That's what I'm totally Peter.
You are.
Using manipulating Kevin Smith's career in order to further my argument about how good Dogma is.
Well, some other notes, corrections here.
Wait, I've got it.
Okay.
Ambassador Sunshine.
I like it.
Anne Kerrigan.
And Ambassador Sunshine. I like it a lot, Sam. This one, Scott Harris wrote in. He wasn't alone who wrote in to correct something I said on the show, which is I said Little Children, the new Todd Field film, is based on a short story, but it's actually not. It's
novel.
A novel by Tom Perrotta. So I believe he wrote the novel Election.
That's right.
Alexander Payne's Election was based on it. So thanks, Scott, and everyone else who corrected me on that. A few other notes here, Sam. You get your notes ready. I'm going to keep going through some of these notes I wanted to mention here. Are you getting organized?
There we go. Listen to that. Can you hear that?
Yeah. Nicely done.
You
we got
that.
An email. I do hate that. We got an email from one of our listeners. I'm sorry again. I don't have it written down. But Bergman, his cinematographer, Sven Nykvist.
Oh, you should have let me pronounce it.
I should have let you pronounce it. But his top cinematographer, he also worked with Woody Allen, of course.
Right.
Bergman being Woody's idol on Crimes and Misdemeanors, among other films, I believe. Not just that one, I'm sure. He just died after a long illness. He was 83. So we just wanted to have a moment of silence for Sven Nykvist.
And
a moment of silence for Sven Nykvist? Are you even listening to me?
I'm not paying any attention.
Are you even listening?
I was going to say that our review of Idiocracy will be in honor of Sven Nowitzki. Sounds like I'm mocking him. Sven.
Sam.
Nykvist.
You're going to hell.
Jesus.
You're going to hell.
Oh,
okay.
As we're going to Idiocracy.
Are we unplugged here? Is this... Are we live?
Are we live now?
Is this being recorded?
Oh, God.
Okay. Another note here. John Andreessen, Birmingham, Alabama, wasn't alone in pointing out that a while back we read an email from a listener who suggested that you have to see World Trade Center only because it's going to be
Part one.
The first in a trilogy. Just wait. Oliver Stone, he's made his safe movie. Now he's going to make his hardcore really offensive, controversial film. Sure enough, we get all these emails, and
it turns out that
Oliver Stone wants to make another movie about the 9/11 terrorist attacks because the subject matter is too huge to cover, and he says that he has uncovered countless tales about the atrocities, and he wants to bring them all to the big screen.
Namely, that Donald Rumsfeld himself, I think, put the plunger down and brought the World Trade Center
down
himself.
But the listener who initially wrote that in, we'll have to look your name up to give you some credit because apparently it's true.
Insight.
You were right on.
Yep.
Okay. Well, it's time for the Sven Nykvist Memorial Review of Idiocracy, Sam.
Well done.
Okay. Thank you.
Nowitzki?
Yeah. Nice. He's German. Plays basketball.
That's right, for the Mavericks. All right. Okay. Well, if you're listening to the show and you're saying to yourself, I didn't know Mike Judge made a new movie, or I've never even heard of Idiocracy, don't worry. You're probably not alone, and you may even be residing in one of the six markets, although I don't know if it's six anymore.
Probably
not. I think it started with six, 130 theaters. It's down to about 10 now. You know, maybe you're in one of those cities and you've tried calling Movie Phone, or did try calling Movie Phone and searched in vain for Idiocracy, but it was only labeled under Untitled Mike Judge Comedy. It's all part of 20th Century Fox's ingenious marketing plan, whose goal is to make sure no one sees the movie. It's bizarre. I mean, this is the man who directed Office Space, one of the most beloved cult films of the last decade. Idiocracy, we're assuming, must be just horrible. I mean, when a studio gives a movie a very quiet theatrical release with no marketing support and makes no effort to screen the movie for critics, it's usually a pretty good indication that the movie is terrible. All right, well, the plot. The plot has most average man in the military, Private Joe Bowers, played by Luke Wilson, taking part in a military experiment that is supposed to put him into hibernation for a single year, but due to complications, 1 year becomes 500 years. When Bowers is finally roused from his slumber, he discovers to his horror that the human race has devolved, and he is the smartest person on Earth. Adam, this is a strange situation. The way 20th Century Fox has treated this movie gives every indication that it's a total bomb. Then there are the rumors that corporations like Starbucks, Costco, and Fuddruckers threaten 20th Century Fox with a lawsuit due to their depiction in Judge's film. I, for one, will never be able to look at a Fuddruckers sign the same way again. So maybe they have a point. What's your verdict? Bad movie, given the treatment it deserves, or comic masterpiece unfairly treated by its studio?
I don't get anything in the middle.
Nothing in the middle.
It has to be an extreme.
Masterpiece or total bomb?
Well, I'm afraid that's where I'm going, because it isn't by any means a comic masterpiece. It's not nearly as good as Office Space, for example, but it's also not total trash, and it doesn't deserve the treatment it's getting, not at all. And I think that, like a lot of comedies, this is something that occurred to me. Comedies like this that can be juvenile, smart, ultimately, but juvenile, like even a Talladega Nights, they are films that end up being funnier in the setup of the film in the first 20 or 30 minutes.
Right.
And then as the film progresses, as we actually get into the plot, so to speak, it becomes less and less funny.
Yeah.
And that was actually the case with this film, where the setup, again, that first like 20, 30 minutes, where
it's hilarious.
It's a brilliant spoof even of War of the Worlds, right? You got the narration with the Earth.
The globe.
You're looking at
the
Earth, and you get the narration talking about the planet, and we see in, 500 years in, but we see this, the current state of American culture, of culture in general, and what it's going to devolve into. That whole thing cracked me up.
Yeah.
Really hilarious stuff and really great satire that you expect from Judge. But unfortunately, it does. Once the plot kicks in, once he becomes a guy who he wakes up in this new world, and even that stuff is funny.
When he first wakes up,
again, it's all kind of set up. It's prelude to the plot. He has to figure out where he is and what's going on and why the world is the way it is. But then once it gets into, okay, they make him the Secretary of the Interior, and he's got to fix the crop problem, and then they're going to hang him, they're going to kill him because he didn't make the crops grow, all that stuff.
No, they're not going to hang him. I meant to say
they're going to kill him, yes. They have him Monday Night Rehabilitation, it's called, which is kind of like the Running Man and Monday Night Football, thrown together. That stuff isn't as funny. But the plot, it just becomes, it's just one of those things where, and again, these movies aren't trying to have great plots or even coherent plots, but I think that just once the story, it starts to feel formulaic,
yes.
You know exactly where it's going, and it just isn't as interesting, but the setup stuff, a lot of it's gold.
It really is totally gold, and I have to say, too, I was thinking about why this movie does run out of steam. You're absolutely right. It does run out of steam once the plot kicks in, and yes, he has to solve a problem, and I was thinking about Judge's form of satire in a way, and it's really nice because he doesn't have contempt. There's no contempt. Yes, he's depicting you know, the very worst of humanity.
Right.
But he never has contempt for these characters, and he doesn't even have contempt for being ordinary, which his hero is.
Yeah.
But the reason for me why it doesn't work as maybe really good satire does is really good satire, I think, gets you to a point of crisis by the end. Sunset Boulevard, for example. You know, it's sort of like pointing things out about this culture or this place mm-hmm. or time. And then at the end, there's a moment of crisis where these things sort of come into play. And I think with Judge, his film exists in the state of crisis. He's imagined the worst case scenario in some way. And so there's no sense of it leading up to anything because it's already happened. The bad stuff has already happened. What I did love about this movie, and honestly, I've kept thinking about this movie. It's a strange thing to say. It's a, you know, it's a good comedy. When I walked out of there, I was like, you know what? We could have taken that this exact formula, this story, these characters, and I probably would have been satisfied with a really tight half-hour sitcom.
Yes.
You know, and it would have been totally satisfying, mm-hmm. and there's enough jokes in there that are really, really sharp and funny. But I have kept thinking about this movie, and one of the things I really liked about it was that it reminded me of one of my fears. What if... And my fear was, what if I went back 1,000 years? How much help would I be to the people there advancing civilization?
Uh-huh.
Not much.
Okay.
Not much. I love the fact that what Judge has done is taken a basic fear, probably the same one I've had, and he's like, how far would things have to go bad in order for me to be a help?
Right.
You know, and what he does, I mean, the only thing, and what he's saying is like, we'd have to go so far into the future where things have gotten so bad, people have gotten so stupid, that I at least would know that you can't water plants with Gatorade.
Right.
You've got to water them with water.
That stuff's funny.
And I love that stuff. It's like, oh, because it's got electrolytes. It's what plants crave.
And the way they just keep repeating
it's what plants
the phrases,
crave.
It's what plants crave.
But I love the idea that what I've reminded of it every once in a while. I was eating nacho chips a little too quickly the other day, and I was realizing I wasn't even tasting them anymore. I was just like shoving food into
just
my mouth.
Just like the people just with that yellow stuff that they inhale.
I love that they never point out what it is, or they never make a joke even other than the fact that people are just sitting here with a bucket in their laps.
In a tube.
Spooning this food into their mouths. It's just like is pudding.
Uh-huh.
I love that stuff. And I also just, I just love the idea that he's imagined a scenario I can relate to.
Right.
I really like Luke Wilson in it.
Yeah.
Dax Shepard is hilarious,
he's
I
funny.
Think. And again, you've got a bunch of people playing dumb guys.
Yeah.
And I think that could get tiresome. And in a way it does, but not because they're playing dumb and making each other laugh in some way.
Right.
They have a very particular way of playing dumb that fits into, I think, Judge's whole scheme.
Yeah.
You know, and it's all very deadpan and very funny, and it all fits in. And I think it was really fun.
And I mean, I like Luke Wilson on the whole, but he is kind of bland. So casting him as a bland everyman really does work. But he might even be actually too much of kind of average, you know, too dumb in a way even for us to believe. I mean, I have to say, I don't want to nitpick the movie, but later in the film, when he's the smartest person in the world, everyone around him is literally, you know, like sub-mental here or whatever, sub-humanoid level here, he still can't piece together. He still keeps trying to explain his situation to people.
Yeah.
Even though he knows that they're all morons and they'll never get what he's saying, he still keeps trying to, well, I was in the army and I did, and it's like, okay. And the whole thing with Maya Rudolph, who is also in this film, and she is a prostitute who they get to hibernate with him, and she wakes up in this new world with him as well. There's this running joke about how she never says that she's a prostitute, and he says, oh, are you a painter? And she says, yeah. And it goes throughout. Yeah. It's like, I don't really believe that he's that dumb that he can't figure out that she's a hooker. You know, I mean, some of those things.
A lot of the stuff with Rudolph didn't really work, surprisingly.
No, but still, the satire there. And again, this is a film that I think if some people see it, I want people to be clear of what kind of film it is. There were, I think, 7 people in the theater I watched it with on a Saturday afternoon. 3 of them got up and left.
Wow.
After a half an
hour.
So the kind of people who maybe have never seen Office Space and don't know who Mike Judge is.
Very
dry. They're just looking for a movie and they're going to go in and watch it. And it does feel cheap. It's not as polished, certainly, as Office Space is.
Especially since he's chosen to make a movie where he has to imagine the future
500
years from now.
And he does a good job on the budget.
I think he does a good job.
Yeah, but it's the kind of film where the way it's put together and with the crass humor, some people just kind of roaming into the theater, they're going to be like, this is the worst film I've ever seen.
Yeah.
You can see people having that reaction and getting up and leaving, and they did. But the satire that is there that really works. I mean, this whole idea of the courts in the future being, you know, Jerry Springer, basically, that's what
there
it's
was
become.
I
mean, you can see that,
enough things you could see,
Yeah, and the TV show that's the most popular show on television,
Ow
My Balls. It's just a series of this guy getting his balls hit and getting hurt. And I mean, it's hilarious. There's a great joke later where Dax Shepard finds this guy and he says to him,
the
you
star
know,
of the show.
I love your show. It's great. And of course, then he just winds up and nails him in the balls. It's funny. It really is funny.
And I think he's commenting. And also, he doesn't make you feel bad for thinking that stuff is funny. I think Judge acknowledges that this stuff works.
That's exactly it, Sam. I wanted to say what you were talking about, where it could come off as though Judge is being kind of contemptuous or being preachy in some way. But I think the reason he can't be, I think the way he escapes that is because he makes it very clear that he enjoys a good fart joke as much as the next guy. You know,
yes,
I mean,
yeah, exactly.
He's not sermonizing, but if he is, you kind of feel like he has the right to be in the pulpit.
Absolutely.
Because he likes ordinariness or whatever as much as anybody else does. And he thinks
King
it's
of the
fine.
Hill is all about King, ordinaries and the natural
he
humor.
He sees there is respect in that. Yeah. And what he is really fearing is this future where, you know, unfortunately, you know, Jerry Springer, the people on Jerry Springer aren't ordinary, but right now
they're running extreme, but
what if they become the norm?
Right.
And so he's perfectly content with a guy like Luke Wilson being okay. And, you know, but what happens if it gets worse than that? And so the fact that he obviously likes fart jokes or likes scatological humor makes him the kind of guy who he's not clearly making a film where he wants to prove how much smarter he is than everyone else.
Well, I love that Wilson's point at the end of the film is, you know, in the future, he's talking about, again, he's 500 years in the future.
Yeah.
In the future, maybe there will be films where we'll care who and why somebody's farting and not just that they're farting.
Exactly.
Which is a great point.
No, the satire, the great moment is that the most popular film in theaters is called
Ass.
And it's just a shot for 90 minutes of this white guy's ass. Yeah. And everyone's cracking up, and it won 8 Oscars that year. Yeah. And what he says is, it's a great line that we'll actually care whose ass it is.
Whose ass it is.
You know,
and why they're farting.
It's really
funny. But I think, too, it's like it really does challenge you a little bit not to just trust everything brands have to say about their product.
Oh, yeah.
Simple things like that. It's like, how many people can tell me what electrolytes is?
Right.
And, you know, it's just like, okay, people have been watering their lawns with salted water basically for 50 years. But also, I loved the scene in the hospital where the person that's like managing the desk,
attendant,
the attendant, you know, has to, like, he's explaining what's wrong with him, and she's looking at this keyboard that basically...
It looks like a kid's toy.
It looks like a kid's toy or, like, road signs, basically.
Yeah.
What is it? Is he having a baby? Because it's, you know... And I think it's, like, there are things when you go to a McDonald's or something, people can't even be trusted to make change anymore.
Right.
The computer will make your change for you. And I think there's enough there. He's not just making idle, you know, mean-spirited observations about dumbness. He's like, our culture is headed in a direction that doesn't reward people for having responsibility.
Yeah.
Removes responsibility from people. And, you know, yes, we are buying products that we accept the claims that because Red Bull has, you know, tarium or whatever it is in it, we're supposed to say, well, of course that's good for me.
Yeah.
And of course I need it. And of course it makes me feel strong. And I think there's enough of that in our culture where it's very familiar. I think he really does a nice job.
And this vision of the Costco being like 100 miles long, you know, and has everything
in it.
You went to law school there. That is funny stuff. Yeah. I think any of our listeners out there who ever feel superior and want to be smarter than everyone else, you'll enjoy Idiocracy.
You really will. I think you will.
You know, and so I
think it's unfairly being treated the way it is.
There's no doubt being unfairly treated. And I guess what we're saying is that it does run out of steam. And it doesn't hold up, again, to sum up here. It doesn't hold up to Office Space.
But I do think it will find life on DVD once
it
gets there.
I
really do. And
I don't know.
Do
you think it will become a cult classic?
Maybe not quite in the line of Office Space. But again, I think Office Space suffers from the same kind of late act malaise in that I think his observations of office life are totally accurate, totally relevant. And but the crisis at the end, it doesn't really lead, like, our hero is still a kind of average guy who's not a revolutionary.
Right.
And it does run out of a bit of steam.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's similar in that way. And I think
I don't think it runs out of as much steam.
I agree.
Okay.
I agree. All right. Well, if you've seen Idiocracy.
And there's no way you have. Actually, that's not true. We have listeners in Austin and Toronto and
three cities in Texas and then Toronto. Yeah. But if you have seen it and agree or disagree with our takes, please email us at feedback@filmspotting.net. We may not get a chance to respond, but we will definitely read your email.
And I just wanted to note, Sam, that we will definitely
we probably
won't respond.
Things
we really need to rephrase that because I have to say with our lives right now, they're very busy, to say the least. And I just want to say, you don't know how many emails we've received in the past month. We always receive great emails that I want to respond to. Same with you.
Right.
Just really insightful stuff or interesting questions that I'd love to get into. And we star them and we say, we're going to go back and we're going to respond to that. And then another week goes by, and we star more emails, and we keep starring more emails, and we respond to as many as we can. It's hard. I just wanted to throw that out there, that if you write to us and you're feeling like, wow, how could they not responded to my brilliant email? It probably was brilliant, and we read it and thought that.
Not only that, we probably sent it to each other and said, what a great email.
Yeah. And just haven't been able to find the time to craft a response. Yeah, so we do want to thank you for that. Opening in wide release this weekend, The Guardian, Open Season, and School for Scoundrels. Mm. And in limited release, Michel Gondry's The Science of Sleep. I believe that documentary, also The U.S. versus John Lennon, coming out in limited release. Obviously, we're not interested in The Guardian or Open Season. And
Guardian,
only,
is that Top Gun 2?
Yes,
or
Top
what?
Gun. Yes, Top Gun just, meets Navy SEALs.
Navy SEALs, that's
yeah.
it.
And we're not interested in seeing those films. Mildly interested in School for Scoundrels.
Yeah, just because it's Todd
Phillips.
Todd Phillips, right.
Yeah, but we're going to see Michel Gondry's The Science of Sleep, and we're also going to review that along with the critically adored Half Nelson on our next
ignored?
Show.
Did you say ignored?
I did not. There's no way I said ignored.
What did you say?
Maybe I did. I meant adored. Are we still live?
Oh, adored.
Are we recording right now? Adored. Critically adored Half Nelson. We're also thinking right now, based on a listener suggestion, top five up-and-coming directors is our top five. So we'll be back this Saturday with our monthly Chicago Public Radio show. That show will include reviews of The Last Kiss, All the King's Men, and Jackass Number 2.
Poop.
Plus the top five films we'd save from the 1980s.
That's right. The great, top five films we would save from the 80s. That's a good one. All right. Well, please send any feedback to feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a message. Check out our top five archive, a calendar of upcoming reviews, and more at filmspotting.net. And please help us reach new listeners by voting for us at podcastalley.com. A direct link is available on our blog under Vote for Film Spotting. And also on the blog, sign up for the Dope Sheet, where we reveal very personal information.
We do. We
go
we
to filmspotting.net. Sign up for the Dope Sheet.
We're trying to give you extra nuggets of information that I'm sure all of you love to hear about who we are.
That's right.
That's just things we can't get into on the show.
That's
so,
right.
If that's incentive, if that's not incentive,
I don't know what
to
is.
Sign up. I don't know what is. So we'd like to thank Johnny Society and Messenger Records for today's music. Please check them out on the web at messengerrecords.com for Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Sam Van Hallgren. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is brought to you by PeerFlix. Trade DVDs online at peerflix.com/filmspotting. And by Dexter. Meet Dexter Morgan. He's dysfunctional. He's psychopathic. He's a serial killer. And he's one of the good guys. Showtime presents Dexter, a killer new series. By day, Dexter Morgan is a likable forensic investigator for Miami Homicide. But by night, he dispenses a special kind of justice. Dexter premieres Sunday, October 1st at 10, 9 Central with replays all week or watch it on demand anytime. Only on Showtime. To subscribe, call 1-800-SHOWTIME or go to SHO.com.